going to go in order today with Senate Bill 61 and then House Bill 2734, if that will affect your coffee break planning strategy. I'm going to open up a public hearing work session on Senate Bill 61. This is the tax haven issue. The goal of this legislation is to do a technical fix that helps some companies, and most notably Hewlett-Packard. It also updates the list of countries on here, and Paul will walk us through a presentation. And it also removes the authority from the Department of Revenue to change that list. And I should say before we get going that if it was up to me, this would not be part of our tax code. But this tax haven strategy passed, I think, unanimously, if not overwhelmingly, in 2013. All of us up here voted for it, with the exception of Senator Riley, who wasn't here then. And so we have it. And what I'm, like so many tax parts of our tax code, it was added without a thought to strategy, to economic development, to education, and a statewide sense of purpose. It was just a nip and a bud, just like the tax cut during that same special session in 2013. And so, but we have it, and it needs to be tweaked. This isn't a vote to remove it or to overhaul it. It just needs to be tweaked, and so that's my goal of this legislation. And hopefully there's a day out in the next year or so where we can make a major change to our corporate tax structure in which this will be removed. So but for now, that's what we have. Dr. Warner, can you give us walk us through the overall bill and the tweaks that we have in this dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 61?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have two amendments for the committee, and the dash 2 and the dash 3. The dash 3 is identical to the dash 2, with the exception of what the chair mentioned, giving the Department of Revenue some discretionary authority to add jurisdictions to the list if they meet the criteria. So the dash 3 does not contain that language, so it's strictly a legislative decision as to what jurisdictions get put on the list. To remind you that going back to the beginning of the session, which seems like a long time ago now, you had a report from the Department of Revenue that was required by House Bill 2460, the implementing legislation in 2013, and they came to you with a detailed report. That's back in OLAS for you to refer back to if you need to. But they were directed to go through look at individual jurisdictions, those that were on the list, which, as you recall, were based on the Montana statute, and then to recommend any changes to that list. So if you go to the dash 3 amendment, some of those changes are built in along with several other things, and I'll just mention them briefly. The first thing under section 2, line 12, there's reference to a corporation filing a separate return on the dash 3 amendment. That's just a technical correction and oversight to the original bill 2460. So that has been included to make sure that that's that technical change is made. The list that shows up under section 21B contains all of the individual jurisdictions that were in the original, in the current statute. The one change is the Netherlands and Antilles broke up, is no longer a political entity. And so what the list does is include five separate jurisdictions now that used to be the Netherlands and Antilles. So those show up in there on that list now. The substantive changes to the list, there are four additional jurisdictions that are added, and they're just kind of sprinkled in there. One is Hong Kong. Second is Guatemala. Third is Panama. And fourth is Trinidad and Tobago. So those are all added to the list. The Department of Revenue's recommendations did include two other countries, the Netherlands and Switzerland. Those two countries are not in the dash 3. They're not in this amendment. So they would not be added to the list if you adopt this amendment. At the top of page 2, Section 2 refers to what the chair referred to, the correction in terms of some companies that were, the feedback we got were companies that would have income reported in a listed jurisdiction, but that income did not originate from the U.S. So in other words, it originated from another country, but not the U.S. So it was still being reported in that jurisdiction. So the sub 2 there makes that correction by allowing those corporations, they still have to report that income in the jurisdiction, but they can then, as you can see, the language which is on lines 4 and 5 is they can eliminate that income from federal taxable income. So in other words, they can pull it back out so it's not part of the tax base. And I'll show you how that works in just a minute, the kind of the mechanics of it. So that is a key change in the amendment, a key change to the current statute. The other component that's a change to current law is in Section 4, which is on page 4. And what this does is, if you recall, the original statute just had the listed jurisdictions, and that was based on the Montana experience. We had a lot of documentation and research to base that on, but there wasn't anything specifically in statute. What Section 4 does is it puts in verbatim the criteria used, recommended by the Multnomah State Tax Commission. And this is what the Department of Revenue used in their recommendations to you in their report. So those would be put into the statute, and you can see them listed there beginning on line 25 of page 4, those individual jurisdictions. There's 5 of them, of those individual criteria. So, and then finally, the last point would be that the these changes would take place January 1, 2016. So there would be, for the corporate tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2016, those changes would take place. So that's the amendment. One thing I would like to do, just to give you a sense of kind of how the mechanics work, would be to turn to a examples that we have, and this kind of gives you an idea of how these components work. I have hard copies if anybody wants a hard copy here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Two more.
We'll take two. I'll pass one down. Okay. One hard copy.
You're getting one.
Okay.
Okay, so a lot of numbers here, but I think it illustrates how some of these different components work. And particularly how the changes that are in your amendment about income reported in a jurisdiction that did not originate from the U.S., and also how the sales factor interacts to determine the liability of a corporation. I've got 3 examples here. The first is consolidated return A, and in this case, the under current law, under previous 2460 law, that return would show a water's edge or within the U.S. total sales. In this example, it's $95 billion. They would have a net income at the national level reported on their federal return. That would be $5 billion in this example. And, of course, the amount that gets apportioned back to Oregon under our apportionment formula is strictly based on sales. So in this example, they would have sales of $4.75 billion. That would be divided by their total water's edge sales of $95 billion, which means Oregon would get 5% of that net income. So 5% of the $5 billion would come back to Oregon, and then that's $250 million being apportioned, using our tax rates to be about $19 million. So now when the legislation passed in 13, where you had to include the income in a listed jurisdiction, that shows up for consolidated return A, and this example really is the pure tax haven. In this case, you've got a consolidated return showing income in that jurisdiction. It has no sales in that jurisdiction, so it's suggesting that there's not a lot of economic activity going on, at least based on sales. And also, it doesn't have any income that's not attributable to U.S. affiliates. So in other words, all of that $1 billion originates from the U.S. and it's reported in the tax haven. So under our current law, that would have to be added to the income that's apportioned back to Oregon. Oregon's sales factor would stay the same because there are no sales in the jurisdiction at 5%. So it'd be 5% of 5 billion plus a billion, so 5% of 6 billion. And that means that the income apportioned back to Oregon would be 300 instead of 250, and apply the same tax rate, and this consolidated return would have a $3.8 million increase in its tax liability to Oregon. And that's how the current law works. If you look at consolidated return B, the top part is all the same. But in this case, we still have the $1 billion in income reported in this jurisdiction. However, only 500 million of it can be attributable back to U.S. affiliates. So the other 500 million is coming from is being reported in the listed jurisdiction, but is not from the U.S. So what the -3 amendments would allow a corporation to do is to still have to report the $1 billion in the income in the jurisdiction, but they could eliminate 500 million of it because it's not U.S. origin. So in this case, their additional income that would be subject to tax would be the 500 million. That it's then apportioned back to Oregon. So 275 is apportioned to Oregon, and the increase over previous law under with no jurisdiction reporting is 1.9 million. So instead of 3.8, it's up 1.9 or half, and that's the effect of the -3 amendment. In this case, it reduces this additional tax from the foreign affiliate by half. And then in the last example, to add in what could reflective of not a pure tax haven where there is economic activity as measured by sales. In this case, I've assumed sales of $5 billion. So you still have $1 billion in income reported in that jurisdiction, half of which comes from a non-U.S. source. But now notice that the sales factor in Oregon has to account for the fact that you add the income from the jurisdiction, but you have to also add the sales. So instead of being 5% of total income apportioned back to Oregon, it's 4.8%. So in other words, it's been reduced by the fact that there are sales taking place in that jurisdiction. So even though it's on the list, the sales in that jurisdiction have to be accounted for. So in this example, because of the sales factor, because half of it is not U.S.-based, the increase in taxes on this income is $900 million. So that gives you kind of a sense of what the interaction of how those components work, both in terms of the income originating from another country and also the sales factor. So what we did on the revenue impact is when we looked at different jurisdictions that were listed and tried to estimate what the revenue impact we have, income or net income reported from U.S. affiliates from national data. We used that as the base, but then we adjusted it for the size of the GDP of that jurisdiction, using that as a proxy for the amount of sales. So that gave us, that was how we tried to factor in the apportionment formula. If you look at the revenue impact, you can see that the net effect of the -3 is a very slight increase. It's the sum of two offsetting factors. One is the additional jurisdictions that are added, and therefore you have more income to report back to Oregon and apportion back to Oregon. That increased overall revenue by roughly $1 million a year. And then if you look at the adjustment called for by income that was not U.S., did not originate in the U.S., we reduced income by about $800 million a year for that reason. So you have a net of plus two, and for biennium basis, 0.4 in terms of the net revenue impact of those two components. Again, I would emphasize that as we're, even though you passed 2460 in 2013, it was first applicable to the 2014 corporate tax year, and we have no data on what the effect of the original list was. So we're still operating strictly on secondary data. We hope to, certainly by the time we get into next long session, to have a full year's data to at least look at and see what was generated by those individual jurisdictions.
Thank you. Can we go back to your tax haven chart? On your first example, can you give us more of a realistic hypothetical on a country shelter, what we're looking at there?
Mr. Chair, if you know, this is the consolidated return, A would be the more the pure tax haven. And you know, I think if you look at your list, there's a number that would come to mind. One, for example, that's been kind of a classic over the years is the Cayman Islands, okay. Which is basically the image is of essentially a postal address in which income is reported, but there's no real economic activity taking place there. So it's the classic case of, remember you talked about base erosion and profit shifting, the BEPS. Well, that's the profit shifting. Would be where your income is earned in another country, but it's being reported or shifted into a tax haven like the Grand Cayman Islands, for example, or the Bahamas is another one that's fairly large in terms of at least the dollars reported. So that income is being reported there, but the economic activity is not taking place there.
Questions of Dr. Warner? Senator Boquist, you were one of the authors of the tax haven concept.
I was one of the participants in the negotiations of the grand bargain. This is one of the products of it. And as you said, Mr. Chair, it probably was a really bad idea, and we did it anyway. And we all make mistakes and should learn from our mistakes. But I guess, Mr. Warner, in the lists that are up here, I'm trying to, figure out there in the technical amendments. I think you explained one of the sections. I believe it's section sub 2 is the, for better word, the HP fix. Is that not correct?
Yes, Senator. The if you look at the sub 2, the top of page 2, it says after making any addition required by 1A. So if you've got reported income in one of those listed jurisdictions, you have to report it. But then you can turn around if it is not attributable directly or indirectly to activity or transaction with a unitary business included in the federal consolidated or separate return, then you can eliminate it. In other words, take it back out. So it wouldn't be subject to tax.
Okay, follow-up question, Mr. Chair. And then in Section 4, you made mention we added sub-items 1 through 5, which I believe you said were out of the interstate tax compact language. Is that not correct?
Yes, Senator. This language is verbatim from the recommendations from the Multi-State Tax Commission, and those appeared in the Department of Revenue's report, and it was the basis for their recommendations on adding or subtracting jurisdictions from the list.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. And then going, you know, backwards, predating this, I guess first the Multi-State Tax Commission is fine, except only one state and Oregon, so two states have adopted this whole idea, but going back to the discussions way back when, several years ago, sort of the model of trying to figure out what was not a tax haven and what was, the preeminent experts was the OECD and European Union. And I thought back in those days we were looking and trying to identify, you know, who are the accepted tax havens. I mean, as example, everybody says Switzerland. Fact of the record in the last 3 years is that Switzerland has 100 banks that have either been indicted or entered agreements with the Department of Justice and Internal Revenue Service, which I guess is the reason they're the number one on the list across the board. And if you go to the OECD report, which I think we actually have online someplace from way back in February, it does, for example, list Switzerland as one of those as an example. But then it lists, you know, the largely compliant nations that should not be considered as tax havens to include the United States, the Netherlands, and Hong Kong, China. So I'm trying to figure out the correlation in the revenue departments, how they came about doing it this way when OECD and the European Union and the American government are going a different direction. So,
Senator, the report lists the reasons for the individual jurisdictions being included. And I will point out Switzerland is actually recommended to be included on the list, even though it's not in the dash threes. Mm-hmm. But the basis for it is the criterion that's listed here in statute. And the determination by the study by Department of Revenue was there was one main criteria related to the effective tax rate, and then one of the other secondary criteria that were not met by that particular jurisdiction, and that's why they're recommended to be on the list.
Hmm. Okay. Just a comment, Mr. Chair, if you would.
Senator Volkowitz.
The HB fix, the rulemaking fix, that we have to do something because there's a much more draconian bill sitting on the House of Revenue or the House Revenue Committee on the far side, I get, but it is my preference or my observation that, yes, we screwed up, including myself, in doing this the first time. And so adding anybody new really opens Pandora's box. If we're going to go back and review it over the next 2 years, it seems to me the technical fixes are the best way to go. But that's just my personal observation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bartschuker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember 2013 and getting dragged through the mud on this the first time. My question back then is still the same question now. Are we spending a dollar to recover a dime is what I'm worried about. And you kind of just took, all the momentum out of the question I was going to ask you, Dr. Warner, have we recovered anything? And you've already stated that we're still going off of secondary information and we really don't have any information on if we are recovering anything. So
that's true, Senator. But one thing I would point out is we've been very clear in the original bill that passed in 13 that we will be in a position to track it closely. So it's a reported add back on the returns. So the department's already set up a mechanism so that we will be tracking and knowing exactly what comes in as a result of this. And when we look at, for example, the data from Montana, they're able to walk back and show exactly what came from their legislation. And that's the basis of our estimates. So we'll set up a similar kind of tracking mechanism. We'll be able to tell you exactly what it is.
Follow up. Will we also be able to know how much it's costing the state to track? So we can, what I'm looking at is, how much are we spending and how much are we covering for how much we're spending? I just don't want to get in the business of spending a dollar to recover a dime. That doesn't make much sense to me.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As was noted, I wasn't here, but I hear everyone saying we did something bad. Can someone explain to me why it's bad?
Well, I'll take a crack at that. First, it was not done with any kind of economic development strategy or tax code strategy in trying to sync up our tax code with the state's purpose, education, putting us in sync with our own economy. It was one little tiny bite or nip and tuck. So there's one. The other thing is it's just a bizarre, almost surreal feeling that we're sitting up here on this panel discussing the merits of adding Hong Kong, but not the Netherlands, but Trinidad and Tobago, and some of these countries I've never even heard of. For a state government to be discussing that is an indictment on our federal government in not regulating this. So that's part of it. And Senator Boquist, in all fairness, was charged with an impossible task a few years ago, and that was to come up with something creative that had to work in with several other pieces of that pie in order to create the politics needed to pass something that was necessary, very necessary at the time. And so that's what we came up with. That's what we have. This isn't a vote today or tomorrow to repeal this or to overhaul it, but to make some fixes. So Senator Boquist, you want to take a crack at that?
I'd be happy to, because the discussions that were in the work group and led up to this being one of the, you know, little teeny pieces of the grand bargain and other things like that, I think it's, I mean, even if you look out in the audience of the lobbyists, when everybody says this is a bona fide tax haven, everybody as an individual says, yeah, we should go after the tax havens that are, you know, avoiding taxation, so on and so forth. The discussions actually in those days revolved around three topics: is OECD, which is the precursor to the European Union, and they have done this for decades and decades and decades, and they have a very short list, as I say, that's published, that these people are everybody kind of agrees. Then you had European Union, this short list kind of agrees, and then the next list was sort of the IRS and the U.S. government sort of agrees, and then for whatever reason, we kind of decided to do our own parameters, and some of them got added, some of them didn't get added, and other people got added, and so the original thought process that was in that group, if you're going to do this, is, you know, this narrow group that everybody agrees to agree upon because they've been doing it for decades. And then, like I said, half the list for political reasons got pulled off. Other people got added on. And it kind of ended up, as the good chair said, something that, you know, sounded like a really good idea and has gone off the tracks. So that's the historical perspective from there. I believe Senator Edwards has a question.
Senator Edwards.
Yeah. Well, I agree that the fixes, the technical fixes, make a lot of sense to me. This does feel bizarre. I mean, even the criteria that are used are broad and somewhat descriptive, but really open to interpretation and different interpretations, as I've been reading them. And I don't know, Mr. Chair, it just, this is, it is surreal that we're talking about this in this committee in Salem, Oregon, and without much of a finger on the pulse of the of international business, of international investment. I mean, I don't know, this expanding the list to me at this point without it, just I'm feeling uncomfortable with it, but the technical fixes seem like they need to happen. So
is that right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I guess what I heard most is we're just using the wrong list. That seems to be what I hear is what's wrong. We're using the wrong list.
Well part of that change here is there's in the current statute, in the law, are countries that are no longer countries. So we have to make some changes and update that. And I guess the debate really boils down to what extent do we update the list and include countries? Where do we draw the line from what is a tax haven and what isn't?
Right.
Well, let's keep marching forward here in our foreign policy discussion, Oregon Department of the Oregon Revenue Committee, the Senate. It's called Dan Jarman and Hewlett Packard. Is there a sign?
That's a good idea. There's some Bermuda on this.
Members of the committee, and Chair Haas, Dan Jarman representing Hewlett-Packard. I wanted just this morning to introduce to you Lauren Alusik with Hewlett-Packard, based in California, and let him make some remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Good morning. Thank you, Senator Haas, Chairman Haas, members of the committee, for taking the time to focus on this issue. I just recently heard a couple folks calling this the HP fix. Well, we appreciate the attention that's been paid to it relative to HP.
Start off with your name.
Oh, I apologize.
ID,
thank
serial
you.
Serial number.
No problem. My name is Lauren Alusik. I'm with Hewlett-Packard, Inc., and I my title is Director of Government Relations for the Western Region. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, thank you again for focusing on this. The foreign-to-foreign transactions are the things that in Section 2 that you guys are considering to be a technical fix. We believe that it's an appropriate technical fix. The overall policy, I think you guys are also debating, and it is a scenario in which we don't necessarily embrace the overall policy. However, we understand that this is what is on the table. So we appreciate, again, the technical fix. That's all I have to say.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Just for to correct the record, while we did use a specific company, I do believe this has a broad application across for economic development, not just one company. So.
Thank you.
And not to put you on the spot here, but can you offer us some perspective on how giant multinational companies like yours operate in Luxembourg or other small countries, why you do it, and just give us some perspective to let us know that this is common and let us know why it's common.
I can offer a limited perspective, but the short of it is we have a policy to reduce expenses, and in doing that, operating in various countries, we take an overall look at all the policies involved, and we operate in those countries based on a way to minimize our expenses.
Meaning federal tax code, meaning federal tax rates, meaning the federal corporate tax?
In all policies. Within the law, we definitely operate in ways that minimize expenses.
Okay. And without this change, say we don't get the bill passed, then what kind of problem does that set up for you?
It'll have a relative to pre-tax haven law and current post-tax haven law, there'll be a large increase in our tax liability in the state of Oregon.
Questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Molly McGrew.
Okay.
Senator Haas, I'd also like to invite Rocky up here as part of a AFI representation.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Haas, and members of the committee for your testimony this morning, and we greatly appreciate on behalf of the Netherlands of your admission that certainly unintended consequences did occur, and we appreciate your thoughtful review of not only this legislation, but also some technical fixes that have been presented to your committee. In March, the Netherlands actually presented a delegation here in Oregon, dispatched them from Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and The Hague, in order to meet with Democratic and Republican legislators to talk about their concerns with House Bill 2099, and those concerns still are with us today with Senate Bill 61. We appreciate the Dash 2 amendments that were provided by Hewlett-Packard, and certainly agree that it does benefit us as well. And we also do support the Dash 3 amendments in addition to that. But overall, we understand that the underlying context of the bill is something that we still disagree with completely. The Netherlands is not a tax haven, and we have made that argument to the Department of Revenue and also on behalf of our country with each of these legislators. So we greatly appreciate your review of both Senate Bill 61 and the two amendments that are presented, as well as any thoughtful considerations for other technical fixes that might be necessary in order to further economic development in this state. Thank you.
Rocky.
Chair House, members of the committee, Rocky Dahlem on behalf of the Organization for International Investment. And our organization, first of all, has submitted testimony on both the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s, opposing them, mostly on the grounds that was discussed here a few minutes ago, what it does for economic development, foreign direct investment, and the underlying idea that the list itself, by naming jurisdictions as opposed to activity, inadvertently ropes in, and this, I think, captures part of one of the concerns of HP and why the technical fix is necessary. But with the list as is, it targets legitimate business activity and arm's length transactions simply because those transactions and that activity is happening in these lists of jurisdictions. So, one, voicing our opposition to the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s, as Molly said, primarily because of the flawed approach and the blunt instrument that the list is. We did suggest language to the House bill, House Bill 2099, and Dash 8 amendments, which gives tools to the Department of Revenue and the legislature to actually target the activities that you discussed, Cayman Islands and shifting income places, that would still protect those legitimate business transactions. So we would encourage you to consider that as an alternative for actually targeting the activities that I think that the legislature wants to target. So happy to answer questions.
Questions of this panel? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we have signed up to testify on this bill. It's a pretty meaty bill, so we're going to let it breathe for a while and move on in our agenda. Now close our foreign policy discussion on Senate Bill 61.
Thank you. You put me on his shit.
And move to the subject of brownfields.
Is there a similarity here, Mr. Chair?
No segue.
Well, I appreciate that. I wasn't looking forward to that mud puddle today.
We'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2734. Mazen?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll give the people a chance to leave while I'm here.
You do this every time, Mazen.
It happens every time you come up here.
It's my repulsive instead of magnetic. I like kind of repulse. House Bill 2734 comes to you with a C version, and that's because it went to the House to three different committees. So the last one was your counterpart in the House Revenue Committee, where it became a C. 2734 primarily deals with the perceived properties of environmentally affected properties defined as brownfields, and the idea to try to work with those properties is a new idea of building a land bank. The land bank authority primarily becomes a local government authority. It would be constructed and established by a local government. The local government would give it the establishment, and the 2734 basically puts on the structure of how this land authority is established. And it allows it to incur debt and issues bonds on different intent and projects, and allows for those bonds to be exempt from taxation in the state of Oregon. So those would be part of the tools that this land authority would use in order to acquire the lands and work with them to rehabilitate. Before it became only a land authority, there was a tax type of credit that was part of the bill. This was taken out as it would be developed, I believe, as you would hear from the coalition of the brownfield, that it would be developed in as we go on in a later time. But this would be the main tool for those properties to be rehabilitated at this time. So this is the crux of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Randy Tucker and David Rubino and that team?
Question of staff.
Senator Boquist?
Could you just clarify? I think I know the answer, but just for the record, this is all permissive for local government, is it not?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. I'm Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and I'm here representing the Brownfields Coalition. Before I get to that, I'll say that if the last bill was more of a fine wine that needs to breathe, I'm hoping this is more of an Oregon craft brew that you can pour and drink right away.
Okay.
I'm also hoping that you'll only have to pass this bill through your committee once.
Yes.
Unlike the last time I came and testified. Well, not the last time, but... just a little bit of background about how this bill comes to you. There have been a number of members of the lobby and organizations and governments around the state that have been trying to make some progress with Brownfields legislation for some time without a lot of success. And during the interim, some of my colleagues at Metro began to convene a series of meetings that grew and grew until they became an actual coalition. Trying to take a more measured and rigorous approach to moving forward and getting something done to address the brownfields problem. There are 13,000 or so brownfields around the state. They're in every community, and they are holding back economic development and job creation and community revitalization wherever they exist. And so over time, this coalition went through a whole list of possible measures to try to bring forward to the legislature and narrowed that down to the items that the members of the coalition felt had the highest impact and were also the most politically feasible. And we've got two pieces of the agenda that are alive in the session, this one before you today, and then also a funding piece through Business Oregon. I've distributed three pieces of paper and also put them on OLIS, and I just want to tell you what they are. First of all, there's this piece, and the main point is that map, which is the fold-out piece of this document. This was produced by Business Oregon as a general overview of the brownfields problem, and I want to be clear that Business Oregon is neutral on the bill, doesn't have a position on the bill that's before us today, but I thought that their piece is a good overview of the problem, where it exists around the state, and the benefits of addressing it. Second, you've got a smaller version of this, which shows you the breadth of support for the legislation before you today. This was the floor letter that we used in the House. And third, you've got this piece of paper, which is more of a summary of the bill that's before us today. Before I get into the specifics of the bill, I just want to note there are, in addition to there being thousands of brownfields in communities all over the state, there are also many different types of brownfields. There are small sites, corner gas stations, dry cleaners, car repair shops. There are large industrial sites. There are residential and commercial sites. There is not one tool that will address all brownfields and solve the brownfields problem, and this tool that we're presenting to you today is no exception. This is one limited tool that will address that we hope will address brownfield problems on certain sites in certain communities. Not every community is going to choose to avail themselves of this tool, as Senator Boquist pointed out, and we don't anticipate that every community will create the entity that this bill would authorize. It's purely permissive, and we'll see how it goes, assuming it moves forward. To move brownfields forward often requires a layering of different policy tools and different financial tools, and this is one of those that can contribute to that. As Mazen mentioned, this bill's been through three committees already. It also came through the House with a strong bipartisan vote of support. It has bipartisan sponsorship as well. There have been a number. I'm not going to get into the details of the bill. I'm going to let my colleague here, David Rubino, get into that. But I will say that numerous attorneys have munched on this thing to make sure it does what we're trying to have it do. And so in addition to David Rubino, in case there are questions, Nancy Klinger from the City of Portland's City Attorney's Office is also here. And if there's a need for her to answer any questions, she's here. I want to note that the Brownfields Coalition is an ongoing entity that we anticipate will be back with future proposals. This is not the end of the work for the Brownfields Coalition, assuming that this moves forward. We will be back with further funding and policy tools in the future, and we hope to continue to work with you and work with each other to continue to address this problem in Oregon. So with that, I will turn it over to David Rubino to talk about this particular bill, House Bill 2734.
Good morning, Chairman House, members of the committee. My name is David Rubino. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Tonkin Torp in Portland, Oregon. I'm not here representing any particular client. I have been an active member of the Brownfield Coalition. I've been an environmental law practitioner for about 25 years, about half of that with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the rest of the time in private practice. So I've had experience doing brownfield transactions both on the public sector side as well as on the private sector side, and believe that the bill before you presents a very viable and useful tool that can help move brownfield development in the state of Oregon. As Randy indicated, there are many, many sites, approximately 13,500 of them. Many of those will never be looked at by federal authorities, which means it's going to be left to the state or the local authorities to have to deal with the problems. Some of the sites are ideally situated, which means the private sector will be willing to come in. The deals can pencil out. They'll be willing to do the cleanup and then do the development. There are some sites that potentially are so bad that they never will be redeveloped, but a government entity can come in and take care of them and address the problem to get rid of the health risk that's posed. This bill really looks to deal with that broad swath of sites that fall in the middle. There are sites that need some cleanup work, and because of it, they don't pencil out, so the private sector is currently not interested in it. There are sites that public entities would like to come in on for public purposes, but are concerned because if they do so, under current law, they become owners of the property and are subject to owner liability under state and federal law. This bill looks to take care of the owner liability component for the local government entities only as to state law. But that is a significant issue because, as I said, most of those 13,500 sites are never going to fall under the federal radar and are never going to be addressed by the EPA. These properties are serious problems for the communities where they exist. They pose health threats, they undermine economic development, and most of them fail to contribute to the local property tax rolls or income tax rolls in terms of job generation. So HB 2734 is looked to remove the impediment of becoming an owner to a local government. And it does this by establishing or giving the local government an opportunity to set up a separate legal entity that would be both financially as well as legally distinct from the city itself. So the purpose of that is to protect the general fund of either the local government, being a county or a city that creates it, as well as to create an entity that can be exempt from owner liability, so the mere acquisition of the property doesn't expose them to inordinate cleanup costs. It's designed to be a local control. The land bank authority will be a decision by the local government first, whether they want to set it up at all. If they vote to set it up, it's then run by a board of directors that is comprised of representatives of the local government, the largest municipal corporation in the jurisdiction, the largest school district in the jurisdiction, as well as community organization representation. The land bank will be permitted to establish land use priorities, so they can be looking at properties with the idea of increasing open space, residential housing, industrial, mixed use, with the goal being that because they come from the local government themselves, they'll have the local interest, and whatever they decide to do should dovetail well with what the local desire for development in the community should be. They also have the ability to set up and obtain advice from local advisory boards. So these would be members of the community that, while not members of the board of directors, would be able to provide advice and counsel to the land bank authority itself. The land bank authority will have limits, though. It will not be permitted to condemn or exercise eminent domain, so there'll be no land grab that will be permitted. It also can't acquire property outside of its jurisdiction. So again, it's designed to be local control to take care of properties that are within the local boundaries. As Randy indicated, in my experience, and I think others will agree, there's really no single tool that addresses brownfield properties. I mean, if there were, One would think in the last 40 years we would have come up with it already. Brownfield properties get developed through a series of tools, and on the private side, tools that have been developed include prospective purchaser agreements and no further action letters, which help private parties both limit their liability exposure and obtain financing that is needed for projects to go forward. HB 2734 looks to provide a different area of protection to local governments who many times are, for lack of a better term, the owner of last resort. If private entities don't want to buy a piece of property and the current owner doesn't want to do anything with the piece of property or abandons it, a local government, just because they're there, has to take care of the problem. And this provides them an avenue of doing so without exposing themselves to unneeded liability. The ultimate goal is for OR, the land bank, to, as quickly as possible, get the property in a condition where it can be put back into productive use, attract private investment and development, have the property redeveloped, and then back on the property tax roll, generating jobs, generating income taxes, and making the property, removing it from the blight category that it had otherwise been in. As I said, it's a voluntary tool for the local government. In my experience, I think it will be a very useful tool. With that, I'm happy to take any questions that anybody on the committee has.
Thank you both.
When you think about brownfields, you think of these industrial sites where there was formerly some big industrial mill or something that in the 40s and 50s did some bad stuff. But you don't think, I saw on your earlier slide, the gas station in Beaverton is now Ava's, and I'd never realized that before. So
yeah.
You're talking little corner gas station, dry cleaners. But what has happened, though? I mean, that one worked, clearly. There was a brownfield there in downtown Beaverton, and now it's a coffee shop. So something happened there that made that worthwhile, that the developer, that the owners just absorbed the costs themselves.
You want to do it?
I mean, it's happening now. There's some conversions
I'll
now.
I'll start.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the owner of the Ava Roasteria has actually come and testified on a few times during this session on elements of the Brownfield Coalition's agenda, Amy Sabarian. And I haven't memorized her story, but I do know that she obtained some funding. I believe she got some state funding through the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund and she basically took on a risk. So it worked out for her. And she's been able to build that into a thriving business, but it's not going to work out in every circumstance. Did you have some more?
Ms. Sabarian also came with sort of a unique set of skills and experience to look at the property. She happens to be an environmental consultant, environmental engineer professionally. So when she saw that property, she was able to, I think, understand the issues far better than a lot of other people do. And that was fortuitous for her, but that I don't think can be counted on to address sort of the much broader array of properties that exist in and around the state and in all the different communities that exist in and around the state.
I would also say that was a really well-located property.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Urbino noted, there are going to be properties that don't need additional help or that need additional help that's already available through other programs, and there will be the properties that really we're not going to be able to really get to in any way, and then there's this category in the middle that's close to penciling out and that needs something, and that's what generally the Brownfield Coalition is aiming at, that category of properties, and this is one tool that can help to address those properties.
Questions, Senator Edwards?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. You said this has been through three committees prior. Which ones?
So it has an interesting story that I'll try to keep short. This bill began with just the land bank piece, just because of logistics in Ledge Council and trying to get the tax piece that's no longer in the bill drafted, and so it got sent to the House Committee on Rural Communities and Land Use and Water. Just because it looked like a land use bill at the beginning, with a subsequent referral to Transportation and Economic Development. So it moved fairly quickly through those committees. While it was in Transportation and Economic Development is when we amended the tax piece, the property tax piece, into the bill. And that's when it was getting its revenue statement to come out of that committee. And Mazin took a look at it and said, wait a minute, this has a bunch of revenue content, you know? So it went down to the revenue committee where we stripped out the revenue content. So it's had kind of a nonlinear path. At any rate, we stripped out that content for reasons. The reason we did that is because the piece we were working on for much of the session having to do with property tax exemption and special assessment just wasn't ready. We need some more time to get that right. So we just felt like it was going to drag down this piece that's before you today. So those are and then the third committee, I guess I said all three committees. Okay. Yeah.
And this is the fourth.
Story. This is the fourth. That's right.
Okay.
That
Mr. Chair, is because we become the one-stop policy.
Yeah, tobacco, foreign policy, brownfield.
Yeah. Right. So there's minimal, if any, revenue-related content in the bill that's before you today. It does authorize the Land Bank Authority to issue revenue bonds. The word revenue is in the bill.
Fortunately, we have the chair of the Environment Committee here, Senator Edwards.
Oh, there you go.
There we go.
Please, no subsequent.
It's June 16th. You described, and I haven't gone through all the text of the bill. It's easier just to ask you the questions. So you describe who must be on the governing authority. On how are those people? Are they appointed by each of the jurisdictions that need to be included, or
the original board, Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, the board. When the entity is created, the board will be appointed by the local government that creates it. Subsequent seats on the board and turnover on the board will be governed by the rules established by the Land Bank Authority once it is in existence, and that's left open to the rules, bylaws essentially of the entity once it's established. One of the concerns about having the local government continue to appoint subsequent directors of the Land Bank Authority is that you need to maintain the legal separation between these two entities if you really want to provide the protection of the treasury of the local government. They can't be in control of this entity. And so that's why they're not listed as the entity that continues to control the membership of the board. But they do establish the initial board.
So they establish the initial board. And then how did you say... I was right.
By the bylaws of the board itself, they'll establish the process for appointing subsequent directors. And we did, in the House Revenue Committee, we did add term limits to the board so that you don't have perpetual, professional, forever members of the board of this entity.
So if my neck of the woods... and this isn't specific just to Metro, right? This is statewide.
No, it's statewide.
Okay, so if Lane County wanted to establish a land bank, could they preempt the city of Eugene from? I mean, we have a very different governing values between the city of Eugene, and Lane County currently. Currently, that hasn't always been the case, but I mean, there's tension at times, so. Could Lane County establish a land bank that said this is how, because we're talking about you said land use priorities with the brownfields. So what I'm trying to understand is if the city of Eugene says no, Lane County doesn't get to overlay the Lane County land bank, the city of Eugene is going to, and there's, I mean, what's, who has the rights to establish? Is it first come, first serve? And
you want to try?
I will try it. Senator Hass, no longer here, but members of the committee. Senators, that's an excellent question. I will say you are the first person who has raised it.
It's because I'm from Lane County.
And the cavalry is coming for you.
I think that there's nothing expressed in the bill, but given that it's designed to be local control, I think that the way the structure would work is that Eugene, within Eugene city limits, would probably have priority, and that Lane County would then, to the extent it seeks to establish priorities, that it would have priorities on land outside of it, to the extent they otherwise didn't coalesce. One would also hope that if multiple land banks were established in a given geographic area, that to some extent they would communicate with each other. But there is, as currently drafted, nothing that says, for instance, the Lane County land bank, if it's established first, gets priority over all territory within Lane County. It's designed to be a local control bill, so I think if the cities were to elect to do it, probably within their jurisdiction, they would, as a matter of policy, it would make sense for them to claim priority. But there is, I will say, nothing specific in the bill.
Follow up, please.
So in the metro area, how would that work? I mean, I presume everybody's on board in the, or the local governments. I mean, metro is, you've been working on the bill, but is there going to be tension between metro and Clackamas County, or metro and an individual city within within the metro jurisdiction if metro wants to do the land bank?
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, I hope not, but I mean, there hasn't been any tension so far in the development of this legislation between metro and any of the local governments in our region. We've been working in partnership. I think we all have the same goal, which is to get these properties back on the tax rolls. Metro's involvement is in this coalition is more as a convener than as a interested party. We're not prohibited from this legislation. Metro is not prohibited from establishing a land bank. I know that several of the local governments within Metro have expressed interest in at least looking carefully at whether they should establish a land bank. I was actually asked that on the record in the House and hadn't really gotten permission to name names, but I have now. I know that, and no one has committed to doing this. I know that, for instance, Clackamas County is interested in examining this option. The Port of Portland is interested in examining this option, and you've got Nancy Klinger from the City of Portland who's come up and I believe would like to try to answer this question as well. And so I don't think there's no sense of sort of, you know, proprietary or a territoriality or turf that has developed in the coalition. I think everyone's happy to get these sites done.
Because you're not able to do it yet.
Well, but I'm not sure what the turf issue would be, because everybody's interested in getting these things done, and if one entity is able to do it, then I'm sure the other entity that has overlapping jurisdiction will be happy to see it come back on the tax rolls.
Nancy Klinger with the City Attorney's Office. Chair Haas, member of the committees. Indeed, the city and the counties and the jurisdictions would be working together. We've been working together on the coalition, and within the metropolitan area, we would be pleased if there was so much interest from the different jurisdictions that they all want to establish their own land bank, and then we would have the opportunity to merge them together. As it is set up, the land bank can be established by an individual local government or through intergovernmental agreements. And so it has the framework to bring a city county together and to do it as one or individually. But as a practical matter, there generally are common goals for the most part that this hits, and if there aren't, then one entity can go ahead and establish the bank.
Okay. I actually have a couple more questions, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I'll take that as a yes. Okay. thank you for, and I appreciate you meeting with me prior to this meeting. I've had a little bit of time to think about it over the evening.
No problem.
And then during your presentation, some questions that popped into my head. So so I had previously been thinking about this in terms of, you know, you've got these brownfields that are out there. It's a problem. We have the perpetual fights about UGB expansions, large lot industrial lands. That's my priority. And as it being a potential tool to facilitate that. But then what I'm hearing is that doesn't necessarily mean that things that the land bank gets lands rehabilitated and put back into similar uses. I mean, I'm hearing things like open space, and which is not necessarily a bad thing, but you presented on Senate Bill 716, which is a great bill, by the way. I know you disagree, but. You presented the map of all the industrial property.
Sites.
Some of those are brownfields, and now I am envisioning the possibility that with these land banks, that some of those properties that are purported to be on the path to redevelopment take U-turns and become open space or whatever within a, you know, and I'm, again, I'm not against open space, right. but I am pro finding more industrial lands in many parts of our state, and I'm wondering if this becomes a tool which can be hijacked to further different land use goals within, whether it's the metro area or other, you know, Eugene, Lane County. So that's what I'm trying to get comfortable with.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'll, and Senator Edwards, I'll take a crack at that. But I really don't think that the intent of the legislation and the reason we're working on this is to provide land that will be used productively for economic development, job creation, community revitalization. We haven't had any significant conversation about this tool being used to provide open space. Mr. Rubino did mention it. It's possible. But really, the land bank is going to be self-sustaining if it can clean up property and then sell it into the market. Otherwise, if it's just donating it back to the public agency, I mean, I suppose the public entity could buy it as well for open space. That's not what we've been thinking about in developing this. We've been thinking about getting these properties that probably are in communities that and have served with infrastructure because they've had some use that has polluted them. So they're somehow have been economically useful properties in the past, bringing them back to economic usefulness and getting them off the books of the land bank and back onto the property tax rolls where they are creating jobs, revitalizing communities, not degrading the value of neighboring properties, and providing tax revenues to the local governments. That's what I've been thinking throughout this process of developing this legislation.
And to clarify, Mr. Chair and folks that are watching, I mean, we've actually had in Eugene specifically, there have been the watchdogs of the system have actually been really good at wanting to facilitate redevelopment so that we don't have to expand the UGB. And so I don't want this – I don't want my concerns to come off as a, you know, finger-wagging at, you know, folks that are – that have a little bit – sometimes different ideas about industrial land development than I do. I've actually been really appreciative of their efforts in Lane County to push politically to redevelop stuff inside the UGB so that we do have those employment lands so that we don't have to expand the UGB. But
that is, in fact, how I'm thinking about
it. I'm just trying to make sure that I understand this stuff because once we set up a governmental entity and it has its – and it sounds like it has the fairly broad authority, I just want to make sure that that's not something that just becomes a tool, a governmental entity that really has such broad control that they can further other goals. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, I'll amplify to some extent Randy's answer. I don't think the goal of the land bank is to inherently facilitate or push one policy over another. It's to give the locals the opportunity to guide their own fate. But what it's also designed to do is try and bring a piece of property back into a place where the private real estate market finds it attractive for whatever uses the private real estate market wants to put it to. So it's to get a piece of property into the hands of an owner that wants to do something with it so they can potentially expend some funds to do some remedial work to get it to a place where everyone's much more comfortable with what remains to be done. They'd have the ability to cost recover so they can get those monies back, the land bank could. But once the property's in better position, the hope of it is that the private real estate market then becomes interested and comes in, and you'll have bidders, whatever they believe the highest, best use of that property is, be it industrial in some locations, or mixed use in others, or residential. the land bank would, in theory, be looking to sell to the highest bidder for the best use to maximize the long-term use of that property in the community. Mm-hmm. That's the goal. It's not to promote or provide a vehicle for any particular policy agenda to be pushed. The composition of the board is just so that the local community itself is represented as a local community exists.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's all my questions for now. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yep.
I'm sorry, Senator Ryan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a very laudable goal. I think it's something that needs to be done. I like it. I heard some concerns from Senator Edwards that I share, which is once a government agency is set up with its own board, they don't always go in the direction that you think they might go when you have your goals set up. So I'm a little cautious there. But one of the things that we've experienced in giving local governments permission to do things is that they go ahead and do them, and then later on they come back and say, this worked so well, we now need more money. Is that going to happen with this one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, thank you for giving me a heads up about your question in advance. So there are a number of ways to answer your question. First of all, there's no intent to, I want to make sure I answer the question you actually asked. There's no intent to come back and ask for any kind of money that's linked specifically to the tool that we're asking you to create today. I did say in my introductory comments, and I will say again, there is no single policy tool that is going to solve the brownfields problem, and we also have an agenda of addressing funding needs for cleanup and redevelopment of brownfields. We did have, the other piece of this bill that was removed so that we could work on it further has to do with authorizing local governments to provide a property tax exemption or a special assessment in order to facilitate the development. We did have a piece of legislation that we that was much more aspirational that didn't move very far this session to create a tax credit for brownfield cleanup and redevelopment. Again, neither of those tools, first of all, they both apply only to private sector, not to public sector owners like a land bank. And second, they weren't linked specifically except by a broad relating clause to this tool, the land bank tool. The incentive for the local government here is to get these properties back on the tax rolls so they're generating taxes, not so that they remain exempt from taxes. The property tax element, the fact that the properties within a land bank are exempt from taxes is sort of incidental to the fact that they're publicly owned, but not the purpose of this legislation at all. So these are properties that probably weren't generating much revenue to begin with. We're hoping to, as we just said in the answer to Senator Edwards, hoping that these properties will eventually be revenue generators. We will use whatever public tools, the local governments and the landowners, I think, will try to use whatever public tools are available to reach that point. At that point, we're hoping that these are economically viable, self-sustaining properties, and that we're not back to the legislature going, help, give us money so that we can continue to run the businesses on these properties. I don't know. That's an attempt.
That's good enough. Thank you very much. I think it's a good goal, and I hope it works out. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Thank you.
No, I believe Senator Edwards has a question.
It's okay. I can ask him off the record. We're running out of time.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
We do have some people signed up. We are short on time. And I don't know if you still need to come up or what, but Jeremy Rogers, Doris Penwell, Wendy Johnson, and Jason Miner. We have about 5 minutes left.
Thank you. Chairman Haas, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Rogers. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Business Council, and I will be very brief in respect to time. I just really wanted to deliver the message that in addition to my role as Vice President of the Oregon Business Council, I manage the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort that includes AOI, OBA, Home Builders, AGC, Restaurant Association, Oregon Economic Development Association, and other partners. All of us are together supporting this legislation. We all believe that the best way that we can support our families, support the state and local budgets, is through economic development, and land is a critical piece of that. Oregon has a limited supply of land. We've done a very good job protecting our farm and forest lands, but we have blighted, unused properties that can be put to use. We've seen how this works in other jurisdictions. I think there's something like 20 states that have land banks. We've visited many of those places. Pittsburgh is a wonderful example. Cleveland, other places that have used this tool along with others to take what was a significant amount of blighted, contaminated property and repurpose it for excellent purposes. Again, this is not the only tool, but it's a necessary but insufficient tool. And so we hope that we can get started, see what we can do, and continue to work on this brownfields problem together. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Doris Penwell, representing Association of Counties. I've worked in economic development areas for a number of years, and brownfields always comes up as a hard thing to tackle. So it has been a real joy working, representing the Association of Counties with this coalition, private and public sector, trying to figure out how can we do things a little bit better, not throwing away the tools we already have because we need them. But when we took this proposal of a land bank to the Association of Counties, there were some counties that said, oh, this might be a good thing. They know their community. They know their fellow partners in the community, and they were quite supportive of this proposal as long as we had the right sideboards on it. So, and I think the legislation, as it's moved forward, has done that. So you have my testimony. It's on OLIS, and some areas in the state definitely need to use something like this. You've been around Oregon. You know what it looks like and where there are problems. The final thing I'd like to say is that there are properties that are sitting there with a portion that's contaminated. So if you take on property, it could be that some is easy to solve and others it isn't. So it'll definitely end up probably, if we can get a buyer, it could be mixed use, you know, some open maybe, some this, some that. So we're just trying to throw everything in the basket and see what we can come up with that would be helpful. Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The coalition letter lists the cities that were a part of this coalition. There were Beaverton, Bend, Eugene, Lincoln City, Portland, Salem, Springfield, and Tigard. These are significant cities in the state. None of them have, to me personally, said that they plan on doing this tomorrow, but they're all interested in it because this is a problem, all these brownfields and vacant lots. Vacant lots mean increased crime, increased fire hazards, increased environmental and health threats, water problems. So those are all costs by having these vacant lots, and then they mean less property taxes for those vacant lots and brownfields as well. So they're definitely a drain on the system, and this is just one tool to fix it. Senator Edwards asked a question just about the conflicts between county and cities. There is a requirement in the bill that requires public notice of any proposed disposition, so that will help make sure that all folks are aware. That's in Section 4, Sub 3 of the bill. So there definitely are the sideboards that we think this local control option will help, and we just urge your support.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Jason Miner. I'm the executive director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I just wanted to highlight three points. One, we're proud to be a member of this coalition. It's a very broad coalition that's involved government, nonprofit, and business entities. It's been very collaborative over the course of the year working on this issue. Two, I do think this is important for 1000 Friends because it's an issue of statewide significance. This affects urban and rural communities. One of the things I've seen during this legislative session, as we've testified on this bill multiple times, is broadening the concept of brownfields from that large industrial site to include smaller sites. Often we cite the dry cleaner or the gas station in a small town in rural Oregon. I think we should also recognize that the city of Tigard was just referenced. Part of the reason that city is involved in this coalition is or in the League of Cities and in this coalition is because agricultural land, areas where agricultural chemicals were stored or agricultural machinery was disposed of, are often brownfield sites as well. So as the session winds to a close, maybe we can broaden the concept of brownfields to include those sites and recognize that cities like Tigard, cities in rural Oregon, have deep concerns about brownfield sites, and that's why they are supportive of this land bank authority as well. And lastly, just to echo what Jeremy had said, this authority is used across the country and other jurisdictions effectively. It's an effective tool for aggregating smaller sites into larger sites to re-enter them into the industrial land bank. It's an effective tool for cleaning up sites and holding them patiently until an industrial user can come along and find a reason to redevelop them into the job and tax roles. So we're supportive of this. Thanks for your time.
Quick question, Senator.
Quick question. Is there the ability in the legislation to aggregate with a piece of property that's not brownfield? So let's say you have a big brown or a small brownfield right here, and maybe a small brownfield right here, but there's a piece of property right in between them. And if you could purchase that, and then you can make one big piece of property and then do something, you know, a different type of development than you would have been able to otherwise. I'm not saying that should be. I'm just going through the options. Could they?
I think we could get an answer here.
Chair, I'll just get down.
There you go.
Chair and Senator, the land bank can only, under the statute, acquire brownfield properties, but there's nothing that would prevent them from aggregating a series of properties and then going to the owner of the other property and then looking to do it all together. Or if the city were to own that property, then you could have the city and the land bank officially work together. But the land bank can't buy clean property. They can buy the contaminated and aggregate those, but assuming geographically they're right next to each other, then you would just be looking to have that one extra transaction to come in to sort of seal it, so then you have the full aggregation you were talking about.
All right, we're going to close it on that. Thank you all for coming. And we'll let this one breathe as well.
We're into the vineyards, this red wine thing, right?
And
more session. Morning, we need to crack a bottle of red wine already.
Yes. I think we need to open up the hot coffee for a while. We need to open up the hot coffee for a while.